Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Alberta's north is crisscrossed by thousands of kilometers of seismic lines. Ecologist Dr. Phil Lee has developed some new ideas to reduce the negative footprint seismic leaves on the boreal forest. And neuroscientist Dr. Rob Sutherland has found a way to make the brain regenerate cells in the hippocampus. And Trevor Thera is paving the way for Alberta to realize its new strategy on life sciences. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. It's not until you fly over the boreal forest that you realize how much access is created by all the seismic lines on the landscape below. Seismic lines place a grid over the forest to help energy producers find oil and gas in the formations below ground. But once cut, very few grow over, and they permanently alter forest ecosystems. Dr. Phil Lee has been researching the fate of seismic lines for the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta.
They're a dominant and persistent feature in the boreal landscape, as a matter of fact, throughout all of Alberta. There are hundreds of thousands of kilometers of seismic out there in Alberta. In terms of its density, it's about 10, it can be as 10 times as high as the density of roads in the agricultural area in the south. So they're extremely common in the boreal north and throughout most of Alberta.
When seismic lines are put in, what are they used for?
They're used in oil exploration. They basically blow charges on the seismic lines, and the sonic waves are used to determine the location and the shape of the oil body underneath the soil.
What impact do seismic lines have on the boreal ecosystem?
Well, they have a fourfold impact, we think. The first is just the area lost, because there are so much in the way of seismic lines. In terms of land clearing, they're the second most common land cleared feature out there, aside from timber harvest. But they differ significantly from timber harvest in that there's an incentive, an economic incentive, to regenerate trees. Timber companies obviously want to regenerate trees and then cut them down later. But in the interim, there is a forest put back. On seismic lines, there is no such demand to put a forest back, particularly when you cut through a forested area. There are demands for erosion control, so that some sort of cover has to be developed, and that will naturally develop in most cases. But in fact, we don't see a forest develop back over seismic lines, and that appears to be a fairly persistent feature out there, that these lines become cleared and they can dominate by grasses or even low shrubs.
Is there a problem that trees won't grow back on seismic lines?
Well, there's a number of different problems with that. In that, the first is that because the lines are fairly narrow, the old lines being 5 to 8 meters, new ones being a little bit narrower than that, 3 to 4 meters, some of them, what happens is that that's too narrow for many of the pioneering tree species to regenerate. Aspen, upland black spruce, and jack pine won't regenerate generally in a spot that small, in a width that small. The second problem is much more pervasive, in that a lot of the seismic, we figure about 20%, and we did some analysis to show this, become dominated by tracks. In other words, it become this unofficial road network for vehicles in the north. And that, obviously, because of all the disturbance that comes with that, prevents any regeneration of trees on those seismic lines.
What do those tracks do to the landscape?
Well, they do three things. They provide an avenue by which invasive species from the south move into the north. And because of the way the linear feature, the linear network that's out there, it's very easy for organisms to move up and down these corridors, essentially. And what we're seeing is things like white-tailed deer and, in particular, coyotes in the boreal north, which we don't have any records of. 50 years ago, there was very few or if no records of coyotes in the Fort McMurray area, as an example. Now we have lots of tracking data that indicates that coyotes are fairly common. They've come up through the roads, but they've also penetrated into the forest via these seismic lines. The seismic lines tend to be dominated by grasses, and that's a very familiar habitat to a lot of coyotes and grassland creatures.
So you've been doing some work on the fate of seismic lines. What are you trying to get from that?
Well, what we did was we tracked seismic lines through aerial photography dating back to 1949, and we asked the question, what was the fate of that seismic line? How did it change? And what we found was that 20% of the seismic line did, in fact, develop tracks and became part of an unofficial road network, we only found that about 8% of the seismic lines actually developed back into a treed cover if they'd started from a treed cover. What's significant about that number, though, is that none of the seismic in black spruce forest, lowland black spruce forest, or black spruce bogs, if you will, came back. It essentially was cleared and remained cleared now 35 years later.
Why is that?
In that case, what happens in the creation of seismic is that bulldozers are used, and the bulldozers take off the top layer of the sphagnum moss and create what was a bog into a fen. A fen is a much wetter environment and does not support the regeneration of trees on it naturally. So what happens is these turn into, if you look on the aerial photographs, almost like canals through the bog forest. They become wet and they stay wet. It's unlikely these will ever come back. They appear to be permanent features on the landscape now.
So does that mean it's changing the hydrology?
It's changed the hydrology of the area. A lot of the water that used to sit in the black spruce areas now drains to the fen areas, and that's what gives them the sort of canal-like appearance, if you will.
But those ruts can't be that deep.
The ruts don't have to be very deep. Literally, they can be less than half a meter to a quarter of a meter in depth, just enough to take off those hummocks and gather the water in that area.
So what do you do about that?
There's not much to do about them in terms of that. Because of the length of seismic out there and its unreclaimed state, a silvicultural program, as an example, to try to put trees back in black spruce areas or even in upland areas would be prohibitive in terms of cost. There are a couple things that will promote tree regeneration on seismic. One of them is fire. If a fire goes through, it tends to remove and create a larger gap and allow for more regeneration. What we're finding when we look at seismic lines after fires is that many of them have regenerated. About 40 to 60% of the lines will regenerate within a fire. Timber harvest can do the same job, certainly if it's planted to silviculture, but even in sort of natural growback systems like aspen systems, what we're finding is about 45% of the lines will regenerate naturally. The caveat is, though, if the line's been heavily used as a road, part of the road network, it will not regenerate because of soil compaction and other issues, development of weeds and grass along the line, those sorts of things will really hinder any trees coming back on those lines. So again, access is a key feature of whether or not seismic lines can be reclaimed.
So this research that you've done on the fate of seismic lines, you've actually put this together in an article that's being published. Where is it being published?
The article is being published in the Journal of Environmental Management, and it should be coming out in a couple of months. It's been accepted for publication, and they're just going through the galley proofs now.
The conclusions in your research and in the article, then, what recommendations do you have for management?
We've looked at sort of five avenues that we can think about in terms of management of seismic. The first is the closure and recovery of seismic, either facilitated by timber harvest or, you know, accidentally facilitated by wildfires. If we get those two circumstances in those areas, perhaps we should give a serious thought to closing the existing network of seismic and only really reopening new seismic or existing seismic with narrow line technology, but in much lower densities. So there's a closure of seismic. In certain areas such as caribou habitat, it may be worthwhile to consider, because the stakes are much higher, whether we'd actually apply silviculture, i.e. go in there and plant trees to close seismic lines. It wouldn't be after the entire part of the seismic, but only would supply enough closure to the parts that connect up to, say, roads and those sorts of things. A third feature we can look at is because so much seismic does become part of the road network in an ad hoc sense, develop tracks on it, should we look at a master road network for the north? In fact, incorporate the seismic we currently use heavily as roads into official roads and develop other roads so that we can, in fact, close seismic. The seismic is an ad hoc network because seismic is put in with the idea of oil exploration. What you see develop are these meandering road networks where people go from A to B. Most of the seismic is laid out on the ordinal and suborinal directions. That doesn't necessarily put you from one point to another point in the most efficient manner. So most people tend to move over the landscape in this checkerboard type of fashion. The fourth thing is in this reuse of seismic again. Narrow line technology is available. No seismic line needs to be really open using old technology, which is basically 8-meter, 5-meter wide blade bulldozers. And the last thing, and this is fairly important, in one habitat, which is a lowland black spruce forest, we didn't find any recovery of seismic naturally. After fires even, we found a small amount of recovery, but it was almost insignificant. In those areas, we really should think about the application of no footprint technology into oil exploration, because that line appears to be difficult or nearly impossible to recover with current sort of economical methods of recovery.
Well, when seismic lines go in, if they go in and they set off these charges and then that's it, do they use these on a continual basis or not?
It depends on the type of operation. In new heavy oil extraction, there's something called 4D seismic, and the fourth dimension of that seismic is time. So they will be redoing it, resetting the charges and re-exploring the oil body underneath every 3 to 4 years as they extract the oil underneath it.
But other seismic?
The other seismic, what happens is that if someone gets a lease for exploration or a license for exploration, they will explore an area, perhaps finding oil, perhaps not finding oil, or making a determination whether that oil is economic to extract. If the economic conditions change, they may come back to that area, re-explore, and then put wells in. So there's this very complex pattern of exploration and extraction. It depends partly on the resources of the company doing both. It depends on prices in oil and gas. And it depends on the other circumstances that are going on around there. If there are roads, for example, being developed in that area, suddenly an area becomes much more economical to work than an area that was isolated. So things change over time, and that adds to the complexity of whether seismic gets reused or not reused. What we should look at is policies that, in fact, ratchet back the area lost currently to seismic to a much smaller amount through a combination of new technologies and different policies on reuse and their development into road networks.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Phil Lee, a research associate with the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta. His findings on the fate of seismic lines will soon be published in the Journal of Environmental Management. When you cut your finger, the skin grows back to cover the wound, and if damaged, pieces of your liver can also spontaneously regenerate. Now, a researcher at the University of Lethbridge believes he can coax a part of your brain to regenerate cells after it's damaged. Dr. Rob Sutherland is director of the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge, and his work focuses on the hippocampus.
Well, the hippocampus is part of the cerebral cortex, and it is a structure that can be found in each of the left and right hemispheres in the brain, near the base of the brain in the middle of the temporal lobe. So if you put your finger just above your ear, the hippocampus is a few centimeters in from there.
You've just received some funding to do some research on the hippocampus. What is the question that you're looking at?
The recent funding we have from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research is directed towards determining if we can regenerate a part of the hippocampus that's been lost through degeneration and restore the normal functioning of the hippocampus in memory and in synaptic physiology. So can we regrow a part of the brain and show that the regrown circuitry really works?
Well, what makes it degenerate, and does it actually lose something that you have to regrow it?
Well, in people, the hippocampus can degenerate for all sorts of reasons. It can degenerate for reasons related to aging or to certain diseases like Alzheimer's disease, or it can degenerate due to tumors or epilepsy. There's a variety of causes of degeneration of hippocampus. We're doing this work in an animal model in which we control the degeneration. Over a period of 2 months, we alter the hormonal environment of the hippocampus in such a way that one layer of the hippocampus slowly dies. And this layer of the hippocampus is called the dentate granular layer. So we experimentally induce the degeneration first in our experiment. Then we return the hippocampus to as normal a state as we can by restoring the hormones. And now we trigger the proliferation of a group of cells that are located near the dentate granular layer to start dividing and differentiating into new granule cells. These cells are a little bit like stem cells, except they can't form any kind of cell. Rather, they can only form a restricted number of types of cells. And so we call them progenitor cells. And these progenitor cells were described in the hippocampus only a few years ago. The dogma was that there are no neurons added to the adult brain. And recently it's been discovered that dogma is incorrect. So we are stimulating the progenitor cells that are found in the hippocampus to replace the dentate granular cells that degenerated. And it turns out that the granule cells are one of the cell types that these progenitors can actually produce. The animals that have lost their dentate granular layer, when we test them in certain memory tests, we can show that the animals don't learn and remember certain kinds of information very well. So they have a hard time remembering where they encountered something. So a person who is missing the dentate granular layer, for example, wouldn't be able to remember where they parked their car or truck. They would just sort of look around randomly in a parking lot to try to find it. And rats behave more or less the same. They're lost in environments where they've encountered something important. When we ask them to go back to that place, they can't find it. And so now when we induce the progenitors to regrow granule cells, if we've regenerated a functional brain circuit, we should find that the animals now will show good memory for the location of important things. And the preliminary data that we have suggests that that's actually the case.
Now, you mentioned in the beginning that you manipulated the process with hormones. What's the link there?
Well, this is a little bit of a mystery, and somebody discovered this back in the 1980s, that if you reduce the level of corticosterone in rat brain, that this class of hippocampal neuron brain cell dies if you get the level of corticosterone below a threshold value. And if you look all around the rest of the brain, all the other cells look perfectly healthy. None of them die. Now, precisely why the hippocampus has this mysterious property that one of its cell types depends on corticosterone is completely unknown. No one has really even come up with what's generally perceived to be a good guess even. So we know that the hippocampus has an interesting connection to certain kinds of stress and anxiety in a number of different ways that's been shown. But why you'd want a neuron in your brain to depend for its survival on a circulating stress hormone is still a mystery. People more or less forgot about that observation that was made back in the 1980s until we stumbled upon it again in the context of trying to develop a good model system that we could use to look at the processes of brain regeneration in an adult. And really the field needs that kind of model system at the moment. People are sticking stem cells into the brain here and there and getting some interesting results, but no one's really managed to recreate a functional circuit. And having one system where you have a simple loss of one cell type and then you can regenerate that cell type again, I argue, will allow us to learn what the basic rules are for reconstructing an adult circuit.
Well, how do you regenerate it?
Well, the cells are there and they're dividing at a low rate. And a number of different factors, growth factors and neurotransmitters and neuromodulators have been described that change the rate at which the cells divide and also change the rate at which they survive and finally change the number of them that differentiated into neurons of the right kind, into cells of the right kind. And so essentially we're looking at those kinds of factors added into the situation to step up the proliferation accelerator. So we're tromping on the accelerator and getting these cells to proliferate much more quickly. We're adding factors in that promote survival and adding factors in that promote differentiation into the right kind of cell. So we're pouring a little cocktail into the hippocampus that is a new granule cell cocktail. That's how we're doing it.
Where is all of this leading you?
Well, I think that in the long run, where this might go, if the simple model approach works, is that we'll be able to discover the basic necessary and sufficient conditions to regenerate a portion of the cerebral cortex. Once we learn the rules, we should then be able to find examples in human patients where people have lost some piece of cerebral cortex function, where they've lost cells, and we should be able to regenerate that circuitry and give people back lost functions. I think that's the ultimate place that we're going.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Rob Sutherland, director of the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge. He's also a medical scientist supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Just a few days ago, someone new moved into the office across the hall from me at Tech Edmonton's Research Transition Facility. Now imagine my surprise when that person turned out to be my old friend and colleague, Trevor Thera. As director of the Life Science Platform, he's taken on the job of breathing life into Alberta's new life sciences strategy. And with his office sparsely furnished with only a desk, a computer, and as yet no phone, I can see Trevor starting this project at its truly embryonic stage.
Well, life sciences is a very broad area, as far as I can tell, and it involves all of the different biological areas of research going on in Alberta and elsewhere, and spanning the range from medical research to agricultural research, pharmaceuticals, nutritional research, nanotechnology, and so on. But the point that really intrigues me about life sciences is the intersection that's beginning to occur between all of these different disciplines.
What is it that you have to do?
Right now, I'm involved with working with Alberta's Emerging Life Sciences Institute, which right now involves me working with the three universities primarily in Alberta and maybe some other stakeholders. But I'm primarily involved with the Vice President of Research Offices at each of these three universities in order to get a handle on the infrastructure needs required for the implementation of Alberta's life sciences strategy. And by infrastructure, simply, what do people need? What does Alberta need in order to be successful with their life sciences strategy?
How does this fit, then, into Alberta's strategy on life sciences?
Well, I think it began with discussions or work that's been done with between ASRA and Innovation in Science. And they've developed a committee from ASRA had developed the Life Sciences Strategy, which I referenced. And that's a public document now that's available to everyone. And now Alberta's in a position to start achieving some of the goals and strategies within it. And the whole strategy, in a nutshell, is designed to take advantage of Alberta's economic position currently and develop a whole new platform for economic development within Alberta.
Can you give me an example of some of the things that might fit within this? I know that BSC is high on the list for Alberta.
That's a very good example of one. And as we know, Alberta's Prion initiative has recently been launched with a $35 million grant available over 7 years for prion research in Alberta, and that's designed to set up a kind of a scenario where Alberta can become a leader or move to the forefront in prion and protein folding diseases in Alberta. And that's begun with myself taking an inventory of who is all doing what in this area of prion research and protein folding. And and then kind of identifying what is all required in order for Alberta to become successful in leading the charge in this area, with hopefully having some direct benefits to Alberta's cattle industry and livestock industry and how to deal with the specified risk materials associated with this disease. Once Alberta has this core capacity built up for prion and protein folding research or life sciences research in general, Alberta can move to the forefront in becoming world experts in potentially finding cures or information out about other diseases that are related to protein folding, perhaps Alzheimer's and other related diseases.
What things do we have going for us right now?
Right now, Alberta has three and maybe some more very excellent academic institutions that kind of house a lot of this research. As well, within these institutions, there's some very well-known researchers and in the areas of life sciences. And Alberta, there's no secret that we have some available capital to kind of invest in this kind of research and this kind of initiatives to really jumpstart things for the province and for Canada.
So what do you have on your plate for this week and next?
Well, right now we're just concluding the final pieces of a strategic needs assessment for prion research in Alberta, and that's going to be going to the Life Sciences Committee for them to evaluate what the immediate needs are, infrastructure needs are for prion research in Alberta. And that's going to probably involve the construction or development of some key core facilities, perhaps in each of the major centers of Edmonton, Calgary, and Lethbridge. Following that, I'm not exactly sure, but it'll be, again, taking a look at what some of the major needs are for the broader picture for life sciences in Alberta.
What attracted you to this?
Oh, for sure. It's a good question, and it's very real. This the whole idea of this field being at a kind of a beginning stage and a stage that's about to explode in a variety of different ways. So it's very exciting in that matter, and as well as the huge array of researchers and types of work to be involved with is also very interesting, from medical research to agricultural research to probably a variety of different research that I have yet to learn about.
Well, good luck. I expect to hear great things in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Cheryl.
That was Trevor Thera, director of Alberta's Life Science Platform. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.